I want to challenge us with a fourth leadership principle, and that is this: living for others, being servant-driven. This has to be in my top five leadership principles. The whole kingdom, when Jesus talked about the kingdom being now and then eschatologically, but now, kingdom living is an upside-down kingdom. In other words, if you want to be great, Jesus said, be the least, you know. And it's the kingdom, or kingdom thinking, it is the exact opposite of how the world says. You know, the world says you better climb the ladder, push, be aggressive. Jesus says, no, you better be humble, take the second position, be last, not first. All these upside down, you know, ways of thinking. So the way up is actually the way down. That's a paradox, right? So what you might think to be true is not actually true. But when divine truth is delivered, it is paradoxical. It's the exact opposite. So when you think about leadership in the New Testament, what would be the symbol of leadership in the New Testament? If there was a single symbol, something that would symbolize leadership, what would that be? Think about, you know, we think about our salvation. What's the symbol of our salvation? The cross, right? And it is kind of funny. You know, I saw my wife wearing one the other day. She had a beautiful platinum Tiffany cross. And I, in my mind, I see it, and it's a piece of jewelry. But you have to understand that the cross was an execution device. That would be like you wearing an electric chair as a piece of jewelry. That's what it was. You know, we make it ornamental. But in reality, it was a torture device, not, you know, so if you contemporize that today, it would be like wearing an electric chair or a rifle from a firing range or a noose, like a really shiny platinum Tiffany noose. And everybody go, that's kind of weird. But somehow we've glamorized the brutality of a cross. Now, that's a symbol of our salvation. What do you think a symbol of leadership might be in the New Testament? What do you think would, where in your mind, think about the Gospels, think about Jesus teaching his disciples about leadership. What do you think the symbol might be?
Shepherd?
That's a metaphor.
Oh, okay.
No, but I'm saying that could be like a shepherd's crook. No, that's definitely for pastors. I think if you want to symbolize pastoral leadership, I think it's, you know, the shepherd's crook, which has two sides, right? One to bonk the sheep on the head and one to corral them in. So that's what pastors do. They bonk and they love at the same time. They comfort the afflicted and they afflict the comfortable. That's what we do as teachers. That's our role. We comfort the afflicted, afflict the comfortable. You're right. Think about just leadership in general. Times when Jesus met with his disciples and he would teach them about how to lead. Does anything come to mind? Exactly. Join me in John 13. Let me show you the New Testament symbol of leadership. Now, this is why this is so counterintuitive in the first century, and it's counterintuitive in the 21st century. Counterintuitive in the first century was this. The symbol of the Greeks' leadership was the pen. They prided themselves in the mind. They prided themselves in knowledge. And the Greeks would write themselves clear, and they would write tremendous volumes. And you can look through history and you'll see the vast volumes that the Greeks produced, right? That's the symbol of leadership, the pen. The Romans' leadership was symbolized by the sword. They would use the threat. They would threaten everyone, right? And they would use threat to force people to capitulate and to follow them. And so the symbol of the Romans' leadership was a sword. Enter Jesus, first century. This is A.D. 33, the night before he's crucified. So this is Thursday night. Jesus is going to go to the cross and experience the brutality of the cross, this bloody, horrific experience that afternoon on Friday. So this is Thursday night. He gathers his leaders that he has had with him for 3.5 years. So for 3.5 years, he's been working these guys. They've been on a killer internship and getting quite exposure to the Son of God. And join me in John chapter 13, for those of you guys that came in late. And let's read this text, picking up here in verse 5. And let's see the New Testament symbol for leadership. Then he poured water into the basin, and he began to wash the disciples' feet, and to wipe them with a towel with which he was girded. So he came to Simon Peter, and he said to him, Lord, Peter's talking. Peter said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? It's a question mark. Like, are you crazy? Jesus answered and said to him, what I do, you do not realize now, but you will understand hereafter. Peter said to him, never shall you wash my feet. Jesus answered him, if I don't wash your feet, you have no part of me. You have no part in who I am and leadership, spiritual leadership. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, then wash not only my feet, but also my hands and my head. Jesus said to him, he who has bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean, but not all of you. For he knew that there was one betraying him, which was Judas. For this reason, he said, not all of you are going to be clean. So when he had washed the disciples' feet, he had taken up his garments and reclined to the table, and he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? Verse 13, you call me teacher and Lord, and you know what? You're right. So I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, wash your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should do as I did to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, nor is one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. I do not speak of all of you. I know the ones I've chosen, but it is that the scripture must be fulfilled. He who eats my bread has lifted up his heel against me, referencing Judas. From now on, I'm telling you before it come to pass, so that when it does occur, you may believe that I am he. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who receives whomever I send receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. So, Jesus' last occasion to meet with his disciples and to kind of give them last words or last principles about leadership. Now, what you have here is an amazing picture because Jesus has picked 12 guys to change the world. Christianity, no question, has changed the world. We look back on that change and think, wow. He takes 12 guys, 12 ordinary guys. Some are fishermen. Some are, you know, somewhat skilled. Some of the writers, like a Dr. Luke, have some professional skill. But the average guy was just a fisherman, kind of crude, rednecks. Guys you would probably think, if you were to pick a dream team, these guys wouldn't be the dream team. So these are just plain old ordinary men. But God delights in that. God delights in taking ordinary people and doing extraordinary things. You know why? Because when ordinary people do extraordinary things, people go, that's not because they have the capacity and they're super skilled. That's because they are being moved and energized and empowered by Christ. And it gives him the glory, and the person's glory is minimized. He gets maximum glory. That's 1 Corinthians 1. So that we don't end up boasting in ourselves. We only boast in the cross and what Christ has accomplished in our lives. So he takes these guys. It's Thursday night. He's going to go to the cross on Friday. He's going to raise from the dead on Sunday, Thursday night. And last words are always most significant, right? If you knew you were going to die the next day and you had a chance to meet with a bunch of guys in your youth ministry, it'd probably be a pretty significant conversation. It would probably be, you know, laden with powerful truth. It would have an element of urgency to it. And so Jesus does something and shocks their world. Because he's considered to be master, rabbi. He's the master teacher. And in that culture, the master, the leader, the strongest guy would never stoop to do the lowest menial task. And that would be wash the disciples' feet. They would have slaves doing this. Now, it's significant to wash feet because this is Palestine. It's dirty. They don't have concrete roads and cement and pavement. I mean, this is just dirty, dusty Palestine, and they're about to have a meal, and he wanted to make sure that he cleaned them. And so he stoops down, and he grabs a towel, and he grabs a basin. That, in my mind, is the picture that I hold on to of what New Testament leadership is. I've been doing this for 25 years. For 25 years, when I think about leadership, I don't think about the sword and the pen and aggression and all these other qualities and commodities. I think about a towel and basin. And I think that's the permanent symbol that I would want to embed into your thinking. When you think about leadership, leadership is about serving other people. It's not about yourself. It's not about building your kingdom. It's not about building your resume. It's not about building your life. Leadership, true spiritual leadership, is more concerned with other people than it is itself. And this is the consummate example. This is a chapter that you just take a highlighter and you highlight from yellow all the way down through this, because this is a paradox in leadership. The world would say the CEO never stoops down to the person who works at the cash register and serves them. Everybody in the company serves the CEO, right? It's just the opposite in spiritual leadership. And so here you have Christ, this is God in human flesh, washing sinful man's feet, and he's never sinned. This is the ultimate act of humility and the ultimate demonstration of slave mentality or servant mentality. This is a powerful text. And so he washes his disciples' feet. You know how powerful it is by Peter's reaction, right? Peter goes, dude, there is no way on God's green earth you're going to wash these smelly, stinky feet. Ain't going to happen. And Jesus said, oh yeah, it is. Because if you don't get this principle, you can't be a leader. You'll never put a dent in the universe. You'll never change the world as a fisherman, Peter, until you get this one principle. That's why it's so foundational and so fundamental for us to understand humility and to lead from the posture of humility and servant-mindedness. Now, sidebar. Why don't we still wash feet? Because Jesus tells them that you need to do this as well, right? He says, I gave you, verse 15, an example that you should also do. Why don't we still wash feet today as a practice in our churches? No. If it's a New Testament principle, why wouldn't we? This is just a little sidebar. What makes an ordinance of a church? What makes something a permanent ordinance or something that is to be perpetuated in the local church? Three things have to happen. You know what they are? I'll save you the mind power here. To be an ordinance, you only have two ordinances for the church, right? What are they? Baptism and Lord's Supper, right? Okay, three things have to happen. It has to be taught and modeled by Christ. So you have that here, foot washing. Then it has to be practiced by the book of Acts, the early Christians. That's the second thing. Baptism and Lord's Supper. You see both happening. And then in the epistles, it has to be clarified or expanded upon. So you look at all three of those, baptism and Lord's Supper. You see taught and practiced by Christ. Further practiced in the book of Acts, so the first century church, post 33 AD, you know, early church is still practicing it. And then when you get to the epistles who are later, late 60s, you see them clarifying it and nuancing it. You don't have that in the foot washing. You have it practiced and modeled by Christ. It's not the practice that he was trying to perpetuate. It was the philosophy of being servant-minded, willing to stoop and care more about others than you care about yourself. And so you don't have it practiced in Acts. You don't have it clarified in the epistles, in the other writers, the later writers. And therefore, it doesn't become a permanent ordinance. Now, there are some churches that still do it. It wouldn't be wrong if you did it in your youth group. It would be a tremendous sign of humility. But you're not compelled by the New Testament to perpetuate this ordinance. Only Lord's Supper and baptism. Those are the two ordinances that the church perpetuates. So it's just important theologically. That's why we conclude that when you read something like that, you're like, our church doesn't do that, and so why? Well, that's why they don't. But you have to walk away with the principle. And the principle is servant-mindedness, or living for others. Not building your own kingdom, but building other people up. And so humility of mind, servant-mindedness, as demonstrated in John 13, is foundational to biblical leadership. Excuse me. There's a ton of biblical principles for leadership, but this again is one of those building blocks, and that's what I'm trying to give you in our five sessions. The building blocks, the foundations for leadership. Listen to Isaiah 66:2. Thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. What is the house that you would build for me, and what is the place of my rest? All these things my hand has made, and so all these things came to be, declares the Lord. This is God speaking. But to this one to whom I will look, he who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word. That's a great verse to commit to memory. God says, this is the kind of person I will look. This is the kind of person I call out to lead. This is the kind of spiritual leadership that I'm looking for. Two things: humility and trembles at my word. So they've got humility of mind and they've got capacity to lead as found in the scriptures. And so we are called to be a self-perpetuating school of servants. We're not masters. We're servants. And that's New Testament leadership at its core. Understanding that will carry you. We're not about promoting ourselves. We're about promoting other people. And so I want to walk through and give you some tools on building a servant-driven mindset or a servant-driven leadership paradigm so that you have a paradigm to be thinking through, because John 13 is a huge exclamation mark to leadership, and we need to be thinking like servants, and that is counterintuitive to what the world thinks. How do you know if you think like a slave or you think like a servant? How would you know if you actually do think like that? It's one thing I could say, you know, I see myself as a slave of Christ. And I think of myself as serving others. How do I know that I'm a slave? I'll tell you how you know. When people treat you like a slave, how do you respond? When people treat you like a servant and treat you not like a master and don't prize you and just humiliate you for whatever reason, how do you respond? Do you say, that's just what it means to follow Christ, that's just what it means to be a Christian, that's what leadership is about in the New Testament, it doesn't bother me at all, and I continue to press on and be a faithful leader? Or do you react adversely to their treating you like a servant? That manifests whether you really understand and you really grapple with what it means to be a servant. So, let me give you some practice. Let me give you some disciplines. And what I'm asking you to develop is a servant-driven mindset, a new paradigm for leadership, where you are more concerned about other people than you are yourself. All right? Let me give you some principles. First, think and act like Jesus. Think and act like Jesus. Jesus is the model here. Jesus is the example. This was the holy, precious Son of God, second person of the Trinity, stooping down to wash sinful disciples, thick-headed, like you and I, thick-headed, ordinary fishermen's feet. I'm telling you, this is huge. So you need to think and act like Jesus Christ. They would have willingly, please understand, the disciples and Peter would have willingly washed Jesus' feet. That would have been no question, and they would have said, look at our humility, I'm washing the master's feet. That wasn't a problem. It was when the master washed the disciples' feet, that was counterintuitive to him. That's what freaked Peter out. He didn't have a category for that. How is that possible? Jesus said in Matthew 11, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble at heart. The last shall be first, And so all through Jesus' 3.5 years with his disciples, he continued to repeat and to model to them the need for humility and servanthood in the context of leadership if they were to make a difference. And so study the life of Christ. Always find yourself in the Gospels and study and magnify the life of Christ because, listen to this, it will weaken your pride. It will dislodge you from wanting to build your own kingdom. It will dislodge you from this pride of wanting to promote yourself rather than to promote others and the kingdom. We're talking about slaves, right? When the Bible talks about slaves, you see later, like Paul, he introduces himself in Philippians. He says, Paul, a slave of Jesus Christ. By just using that word, he is theologically in his mind associating himself with John chapter 13 in slave-like thinking. And you see the writers constantly referring to them as slaves of Christ or a slave of the church. Or that is the proper perspective. And it's a demeaning. In the first century, being a slave wasn't a prestigious job. You were solely and exclusively devoted to your master. You did whatever your master said to his pleasure or to her pleasure. Right? That's what you did. And so when you think of yourself, it would be perfectly appropriate to say, who are you? And I do this a lot around here. People say, what do you do at Southern Seminary? I often tell people, I'm a slave of Christ. I'm just a slave of the seminary. I do whatever they ask me to do, and I do it to the best of my ability, and I do everything I can to honor them because it's not about me. That's just New Testament leadership. And so when you think about leadership, I'm asking you to think and act like Jesus Christ. And therefore, the way you do that and the way you build that thinking is live in the Gospels. So you're always reading the Gospels. Here's what I've done for years. I read 3 chapters a day. And if you read 3 chapters a day in the New Testament, you read the entire New Testament every 3 months. So I'm just constantly saturating myself in the Scriptures. Just 3 chapters. There's not even a lot of verses in some of the chapters, especially when you get into letters. So find yourself frequently in the Gospels because you'll develop a Jesus way of thinking about life and ministry and leadership that is quite opposite, to be honest, quite opposite from the world. Second principle, die to yourself. Die to yourself. Remember what John the Baptist said? I must decrease that he might increase. That's the perspective of servant-mindedness. That's the perspective of slave-like thinking, where you decrease so that he can increase. And the way John could say that is he looked at the cross and he looked at the gospel and he looked at Christ and it birthed within him this immense gratitude. So he didn't feel like he could boast in himself, but only boast in the cross of Jesus Christ. Let's look at just a couple passages that magnify this in the Gospels. Look with me at Mark 9. You got Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, right? 3 of them are synoptic. They have common material. Matthew, Mark, Luke, we call them synoptic Gospels. Then you have John, which is quite different. Each author recording a lot about the same events, but they see things differently. Just like if I went outside and said, Anthony, tell me what you see. Anthony likes green trees because everything's brown in Uganda. And he goes, man, the trees are green. I look outside and think, I like brick homes because they're solid and robust and strong. And I go, man, I see the homes. Well, we're looking at the same thing, but we're just noticing different things. That's what synoptics are. They're the same guys. They were in all the events that together, but how they record them were slightly different in perspective. So not different events, different perspectives. That's all that synoptic means. So you have Matthew, Mark, Luke. So look at Mark 9. We'll just kind of do a little bit of survey to pick up some of this theme of dying to yourself. Mark 9. They came to Capernaum, they being the disciples, 3 of them there. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he began to question them, what were you discussing on the way? So these disciples had some kind of conversation going, and it must have been at least heated. Their voices were raised enough to where Jesus was kind of going, what are you guys talking about? But they kept silent. For on the way, they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. Which was the top dog? So there's three dudes walking on the road, and they're kind of getting heated, and they're all kind of promoting themselves and kind of building their own agenda. And I'm the best leader in the group. I mean, look at me. I'm skilled. I'm a machine. I got abs of steel. I can handle it. I can take a punch. I mean, I can play ball. I'm a gamer. I can do all this stuff. So they're just like just guys being guys and just not getting it, kind of thick-headed a little bit. And so he says, what are you discussing on the way? And they kept saying, like, uh-oh. For the way they came had discussed one another, which of them was the greatest? Verse 35, sitting down, he called the 12 of them and said to them, if any one of you dudes want to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. Then he takes a child and he set him before them, and taking him in his arms, he said, whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me, and whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me. So you see, a child, they were kind of to be ignored, you know. They just play. There's just a little baby, and they're just off crawling and making noise, and adults are gathering together and discussing, and they just distract. So they're like, we don't want anything to do with a child. Jesus grabs that same child, puts it at forefront, and says, you got to be like a little child. You got to be humble, clear faith, trust, willing to jump off a ladder in your mom and dad's hands, whatever. I mean, it's just radical faith. He says, if any one of you want to be first, you shall be last and servant of all. Another powerful statement. I mean, you could feel in the text, you can feel like this knot welling up in their throat, like, oh man, this is incredible. And so it takes to be a servant and to have a servant mindset, it takes you dying to yourself. It takes that kind of thinking. Look at Matthew 20. Another occasion. Let's see. Yeah. We're not going to look at that one. Look at Luke 22. Luke 22. 24 to 27, kind of the same account. 24, Luke 22, 24. And there arose a dispute among them. As to which of them was regarded to be the greatest. So they've got an issue. They continue to wrangle with this. And he said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them. Secular leadership. It's all about CEO, who's the boss. And those who have authority over them are called benefactors. But it's not this way with you men. But the one who is the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the servant. For who is greater, the one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves. I'm the example. This is how you are to lead. You have to learn, listen to me, as a young person, you have to learn to die to yourself. And that's challenging. One writer, John Stott, put it like this. At every stage of our Christian development and in every sphere of our Christian discipleship, pride is our greatest enemy and humility our greatest friend. You remember what Dr. Moore said this morning? God resists the proud. So if you're a proud leader, you're actually putting yourself in the position to be resisted by God. So your leadership has a stiff wind against it. It has God Himself against your leadership style and tact. Because it's not New Testament leadership. Spiritual leadership is utterly different. It's the willingness to be a servant born out of gratitude. You have to learn to die to yourself. Now, get this. If I just told you to die to yourself, that's only half the equation. If I just go around all the time and we have an ascetic sanctification model where you're just constantly putting off, that would be a problem. Because in the New Testament, there's always a putting off and a putting on. You put off sin, selfishness and pride, and you put on the counter quality that is virtuous and is in the New Testament. So you put off pride and you put on humility. Let me say it a little bit differently. When does, to take the putting off and putting on, when does a thief stop becoming a thief? So if someone's stealing, when does a thief stop becoming a thief? When they stop stealing is what you might think, right? No, that's half the equation. It is true when they stop stealing, but that's putting off. That's dying to yourself. Then there's the putting on. So you say, when they stop stealing and they go out and get a job, earn money, and be a normal contributor to culture and society and fit into the system of microeconomics. You see what I'm saying? Putting off, putting on. So half of the equation of servant leadership is you choosing to right here, right now, die to yourself. The other half is this, living for others. So the negative is this. You need to put off yourself and put off your pride, but you need to put on living for others. So it's not enough to just walk around sullen saying, I'm dying to myself. I want to be a New Testament leader. I want to be a spiritual leader, so I'm just going to go around and crucify myself all day long. You know, therefore, whoever's crucified in Christ and talk about understanding the cross. Yes, that's 100% true, but half the equation. The other half of the equation is actually going full leadership, full New Testament leadership, and that is actually living for others. Mind-blowing. I mean, going out of your way to live for others. Look at Philippians chapter 2, because both are seen in this little tight passage. So, think and act like Christ, die to yourself. Third, live for others. Look at this text. A little bit of context, right? Always helps in making a good interpretation. You're reading along in chapter 1 and you start getting the hint that there's a problem in Philippi. Okay, it's been 10 years since this church was established and something sad's happened. They're getting on each other's nerves. And they're taking sides and there's some feuding going on and they're not fighting and fussing and biting each other over doctrinal issues because Paul would deal with that. So in chapter 1, you see him around 27 start calling them out, saying, look, you guys need to be on the same page. You need to have one spirit, be of one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. So you're getting a subtle indication there in 127 that there's a problem. It's not until you get over to chapter 4 and verse 2 where you see the problem. Look at 4:2. He says, I urge Euodia, and I urge Syntyche, two ladies in the church, to live in harmony in the Lord. So you've got two people fussing and fighting and on each other's nerves and in each other's face, not over some doctrinal issue, because Paul would say exactly what the issue is and he would make a clear judgment. So it's over some preference issue in the church, some style of music, color of the carpet, I don't know. Something's going on in a preference issue. So before he ever addresses them face-to-face there in 4:2, he provides a bit of teaching on developing a servant-mindedness towards one another in 2:1-4. Look at it. So in 127, he says, hey, as a local church and as a youth group, you need to be on the same page. You need to think together, act together, be kind to one another, serve one another. And so in 2:1-4, he just nails it. I mean, it's full gas. And he nails it. Look at verse 2:1. He says, therefore, if there's any encouragement in Christ, if there's any consolation of love, if there's any fellowship of the Spirit, if there's any affection and compassion, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. Okay. The word if there in verse 1 is not a good translation. It's better stated because or since. what he's doing is he's reminding them of divine realities or implications from the cross. So this is just a reminder of all that Christ accomplished in their life. He's saying, because you have been encouraged by Christ, because you've experienced Christ's love, because you have the fellowship and partnership with the Spirit of God, because you have His affection, because you have His compassion, he says, verse 2, get on the same page. Start serving one another. Be of the same mind, same heart. And he says it four different ways. Have the same purpose. United in spirit. A true unity. And then in verses 3 and 4, he tells them how to do it. So in verse 1, he says, hey, you've forgotten the cross. Because the cross should dislodge your pride. It should humble you. Nobody stands at the foot of the cross with pride in mind. It's crazy that God crushed His own Son for you and you're going to stand there. I mean, get the picture here. At the cross, He crushes His own Son, and it's the great exchange, and takes His righteousness and applies it to your account, takes your sin and applies it to Jesus Christ. So you stand every day of your life, Romans 3 says, you stand before God, condemned a sinner. And then one day your heart is opened up, and as you stand to be judged before the righteous judge who deserves to deliver to you the death penalty, instead of giving you death penalty, he says, I'm going to adopt you into the family and make you a son. That's mind-blowing. So instead of condemning you, which you deserve, Romans 3, 10 and 11, we've all sinned, we've all fallen short, we deserve condemnation. Instead of condemning us, He actually makes us a son. And this just blows your mind, and you're adopted as a child of God into relationship with Jesus Christ, and that produces this unbelievable gratitude. And they had forgotten all that. You know why? Because they began to think horizontally and not vertically, and they began to get on each other's nerves. And so in verses 1, he just says, listen, remember the cross. I'll get to you later. Verse 2, then he says, get on the same page. Get on the same page. Now, verses 3 and 4, he tells you how to do it. Look at this. You see it both stated negatively and positively. You see a putting off and a putting on. Do nothing. That's about as strong a way that Paul could say it. It's a double negative. Do absolutely nothing. Zero. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. But with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. What do you mean? Well, die to yourself. Verse 3. That's what he's saying. Die to yourself. Look at verse 4. Don't merely look out for your own personal interests, but also look out for the interest of others. Guys, look up. That is New Testament leadership. Serving other people, promoting other people, seeing them more valuable than yourself. Super valuable. With humility of mind, regard one another as most important, more important, super important than yourself. It means you take the lowly position and you take Christ's position as servant, not master, even though you may be more skilled, whatever. Doesn't matter. It's servant leadership. And so in verse 3, he says, verse 1, remember the cross, get on the same page, verse 2, die to yourself, verse 3, and then put on, put off verse 3, put on verse 4, actually live for other people. Look out for their interests. And I can tell you, I've been at this for 25 years. My philosophy of leadership is to promote other people, to do everything I can to accentuate their ministry and their gifts and their strengths, and absolutely die to myself. And that's what leadership looks like. That's how a bunch of strong leaders get together, because they're all preferring one another. They're not into promoting themselves. So how do a bunch of elders in a church or spiritual leaders in a church all get along and move forward off the dime when they all develop a servant mindset and they all esteem the other man more important than themselves? Then the kingdom goes forward. But if you try to advance your kingdom and you try to put an emphasis on your life and accent on you, it doesn't work. Now, look at the exclamation in this passage. You might be thinking, well, how does that, what is that? I get it. Okay, die to yourself, live for others. Remember the cross, think and act like Christ. Die to yourself, live for others. Then what does that look like? How is that even possible? How do sinful people get along? How do the intersecting gears of ministry work without grinding? How does this all work? Look at the exclamation at the end of this passage. Verse 5. Who does this kind of stuff, you might be asking? Have this attitude in yourselves. What attitude, Paul? What he just said. Dying to yourself, living for others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which also is in Christ Jesus. Oh. So he says, the same attitude that Christ had. Going back to John 13, the same attitude. But he goes on a little further. Who, although he existed in the very form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped. But what did he do? He emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of a man. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. This is inter-Trinitarian. It's what we call the kenosis. The inter-Trinitarian relationship that the Son temporarily subordinated himself to the Father. And the Father says, I'm going to take the Son and I'm going to send him to the earth to die for sinful man. And the Son says, I'm willing to go and I'm going to be born to die. I'm going to live 33 years and be crucified and crushed, taking all their sin, put on him so that he and we might experience the righteousness of Christ in that great exchange. So how do you do verse 3 and 4? Just like Jesus did with his Father in the kenosis, that he emptied himself, he humbled himself, and he took on the form of man. So God takes on human flesh, mind-blowing, and then lets the same men that he's going to die for crush him and kill him and brutalize him. That, my friend, is servant-mindedness. That's humility. That's New Testament leadership. That's what leadership looks like. See, it's a character profession. It's about worship. And it's about serving other people. More important than yourselves. So if you're full of yourself, you're not going to make a good leader. There's got to be a self-emptying. There's got to be a death. It's just as if at 15, 16, 17 years old, you need to have your own little personal funeral over here and die to yourself. But please understand, that's only half the equation. You got to go all the way to the next level, and that is where you really see leadership happening, where you live for other people. So you don't worry about titles and what you do. You're consumed with acting like Jesus Christ, which makes you a servant to the people you work with and alongside with and you lead. So in basketball or baseball or military or whatever it is, what does that look like? It means you do the lowliest acts that nobody wants to do because the last shall be first. And I can tell you, there's not a coach out there, gentlemen, that doesn't notice hard work and your willingness to be a servant rather than to try to take the lead and try to be the man. Now, God may make you the man, but it will be because you're servant. Just like he exalts, if you look beyond this, he exalts Christ because he chose humility. He may make you into that leader, and it will produce leadership, no question. Now, that's his choice. You have the philosophy of a servant and of a slave-like thinking in your mindset. That's what New Testament looks like, and that is counterintuitive. It's just the opposite of what you might think. Questions? Yes, sir.
During lunch, we talked about why did John send Jesus to earth to die?
Mm-hmm.
And we even looked in the Bible and so Twitter, it said that God was justifying God and how he punish us and stuff, but also forgive us. And what we came to the conclusion of is that by him sending Jesus down here to die for us, he took took away our punishment, and that's the reason why God still has faith in us and leaves us here today.
I mean, I think what's happening for you, especially, is the lights are coming on, which is wonderful. Exactly. Jesus Christ was the Son of God who left heaven, came to earth, was crushed. He took all of your sin on himself. Because if you don't trust Christ, you have to trust in yourself and you have to go before God with your own sin. And he says, that's not real smart. You need the righteousness of Christ. So he takes your sin and he puts it on Christ. He takes Christ's righteousness and he puts it on you. Gives you the ability to have access to God in a relationship with him and trust him. And that's the question we all have to wrestle with. Are we willing to turn away from our sin and trust Jesus Christ's righteousness? And that's the question that every one of us here, that's the gospel. You have to make that decision. I can't make it for you. Can't make it for you. You have to choose. I want to know Jesus Christ. I want his righteousness in exchange for my sinfulness. That's the great exchange. That's 2 Corinthians 5:21. And so that's the question for you this week in particular, all of us. That's the question. Are you going to trust Jesus Christ or are you going to trust yourself? It's as simple as that. That's the gospel. Right? And it's hard because you got to die to yourself. You got to say, I got to decrease and Christ has got to increase. And that's tough. Absolutely. Good question.
But how we got to that is I asked the question of why God still has faith in us and why should he?
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I wouldn't use the word faith. I mean, he doesn't have faith in us. He loves us.
He loves us, but why?
To redeem us. So that you will be a part of a worshiping community with him forever. He loves you because he wants you to worship him. And that's how, you know how much he loves you? He sent his only son. And to be honest with you, if you said, Dan, give up your son, my little Aiden, my 7-year-old or my 18-month-old, for you, I would have a hard time doing that. That's tough. Who does that? God did that. Because he wants you to be in relationship with him. And when you trust him, then you get adopted into the family and you become a son. And that's what's mind-blowing. And I lay in bed at night sometimes thinking, I deserve death and hell. I deserve complete condemnation. I'm a complete retard, goofus, sinful man. And he adopted me to be his own son, to live with him forever and to worship him forever. That's mind-blowing. I mean, that's the love of God in full array. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. It's love divine. So, yeah. Thoughts about this principle. We're running out of time, but I just want to make sure you understand. Mark up John 13. Let it serve you the rest of your life, what leadership looks like. Because that's what leadership is. And Philippians 2, I think, kind of puts the gas down and really kind of helps you see it in a letter format. Jesus is doing it in real life with those guys. But in letter format, you're kind of seeing how it works in a local church. Dying to yourself, living for others like Christ did. That's New Testament leadership. That's how you live for people. This is what it looks like. And I'm telling you, that is so counterintuitive to what the world thinks. So counterintuitive. But that's what Jesus thinks. And if Jesus is calling you to be a leader and you're in this track, then that's the way you need to think. Josh?
Right, so if we guide ourselves now, we live for other people, God, quote unquote, makes us a man. But if we guide ourselves now, we and people are living for us, how do we deal with
that? Just like Jesus would. You're constantly serving them. So it perpetuates. In other words, it's not a one-time event. It's a lifestyle. So you're always serving people. You do whatever you do to go out of your way to help them. So if anybody, your team, just take baseball, something's going on in your team, and you'd be the first to show up. You're not saying, hey, I don't deal with the first base and second base guys. That's their deal. No, you serve them. You do whatever it takes to help them and help them to be a better hitter, batter. They get hurt. They go through a difficult time in their personal life. Whatever. You're just like a huge servant coach to them. You serve people. And you never outgrow being a servant. You never are going to outgrow. It's not like a one-time event. This is a lifestyle. And so it just doesn't happen once. It's ongoing. Remember John said, I might decrease that he might increase. That's the prayer. As soon as my feet hit the floor in the morning, That's the first thought that comes into my mind. I need to preach the gospel to myself. I need to die to myself today because my natural flesh wants to live for me. I want to promote me. I have to die to that. And then I go the next step, but I'm going to actually go out of my way to serve other people. I'm not going to have to be asked to serve. I'm going to willingly serve. And that's what New Testament leadership looks like.